Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming today. This is our second colloquium event of the year, and one I've been looking forward to for a while. Dan Arnold is here to talk to us about his work in, is Buddhology the right word, or is that just kind of a snarky term for what you do? He's an expert in Buddhist thought, Buddhist philosophy, from the University of Chicago. He did his doctoral work at the University of Chicago, finishing up there in 2002, and then went to teach at McGill University for several years, and then came back to Paradise and has been at the University of Chicago since then. He did his bachelor's work at Carleton College. But some of you may be interested to know that he had the good sense to marry someone who got their bachelor's at EMU, so he was able to kind of round out his undergraduate education in a helpful way, and has gone on to great things. He's written a couple books in his area of expertise. His first one, Buddhist Brahmins and Belief, won the American Academy of Religions, very prestigious 2006 Award for Excellence in the Study of Religion. His second book explores related themes. It's called Brains, Buddhas, and Believing. But I asked him how to describe his work in simple terms, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do it, but essentially it's trying to bring together Buddhist thought and modern philosophical ideas on the philosophy of mind and engaging or critiquing cognitive science approaches to similar kinds of questions. So I think that what he'll have to talk about today will engage a number of us from a number of different disciplines. I've also been looking forward to it because I'm proud to count Dan a good friend and former neighbor. I debated about how many personal stories to tell, and I'll spare him, but in the interest of transparency, Dan and I were members of the same supper club for how many years? Since 1997. We've had a dinner together once a week until 2009 when I flew the coop. But you can imagine, and I'm sure you will after you hear him speak, the many interesting conversations we had over food and drink. So Dan, welcome to EMU. Thanks for coming. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for the generous introduction, Fred, and for the invitation. It is, I'm sure, because of the weekly Mennonite Supper Club connection that I had this invitation. My involvement in the weekly Mennonite Supper Club is owing to my being married to a Mennonite who's a graduate from here, a class of 89. So I've been an anthropologist among the Mennonites for a long time. I've almost figured them out. But when Fred invited me to talk here, and I asked what kinds of things people talk about at these events, he said, just talk about your latest work and what you've been up to. And my first thought was, really? Are you sure? And he said, yeah. So you have Fred to blame if this doesn't make contact with anything you're interested in. I do have a project, though, that I think does make contact with some wider conversations, including some conversations that figure pretty recurrently in a lot of popular media coverage of religion and science kinds of issues. So in sketching for you the argument of the most recent book I finished, I want to especially try to tease some of those out. And what the book especially makes contact with is the recent trend in cognitive scientific studies in religion, which has been a really popular sort of thing the last, I don't know, decade or so, maybe more. And there are a whole variety of manifestations of it. It seems that the most high-profile manifestations of this in the last couple of years have maybe been in the popular books by some of the new atheists, Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins, who are critical of religion in general and as such from a sort of cognitive scientific perspective. Also exemplary of that kind of thing is a book like Pascal Boyer's Religion Explained from the early 1990s. But cognitive scientific research just as often figures, I think, in the thought of apologists for religions who have been just as happy to claim the mantle of cognitive scientific research. And so you see breathless headline stories in Newsweek and Time periodically on the God gene or neurotheology or other sort of trends suggesting that cognitive scientific research validates or underwrites characteristically religious claims. So there's been whether there's been anxiety or enthusiasm about this, and whether cognitive scientific research has been taken as undermining religious belief or as supporting it. There's at any rate been a lot of conversation, a lot of high profile conversation involving these themes. And this is especially noteworthy, perhaps, in the case of Buddhist studies, because Buddhist thought figures with particular prominence in this whole cognitive scientific discussion. So who hasn't read about a study of fMRI scans of Tibetan Buddhist monks who are wired up to show the effects of meditation on the brain? Or who hasn't heard about the Dalai Lama speaking at MIT or talking with cognitive scientists. In this vein, one noted Buddhist studies professor, Buddhologist, celebrity Buddhologist, Robert Thurman, more widely known as the father of Uma Thurman, is apt in his expression of enthusiasm for this kind of approach to call Buddhism a mind science. Buddhism's not a religion, it's a mind science. So Buddhist thought figures especially recurrently and prominently in the whole discussion, which kind of rankles me for a variety of reasons. Now, there are some good reasons why Buddhist thought might be an especially congenial conversation partner for contemporary cognitive scientific work, because the cardinal Buddhist doctrine is the doctrine of anatman, the doctrine that we are without selves, which is a initially counterintuitive sort of claim that actually I think makes a lot of sense and can be elaborated quite sympathetically. I might have to save that for questions afterwards if people want to know more about the sense it makes to think that we are without selves. But for now, suffice to say that Buddhists, with their characteristic claim that there is no such thing as what we really are, that there is, that we don't have souls, that we're not individuated by unchanging essences, hold a view that is prima facie compatible with a lot of scientific orientation. Scientists tend to be reductionists about the self and the person, and so there's some reason to suppose that they might be philosophical fellow travelers. But there are a variety of reasons why we should be really suspicious of the claim that Buddhism fits especially well with cognitive scientific research, and suspicious of characterizations of Buddhist thought as mind science and as uniquely compatible with modern science. One of the reasons we ought to be suspicious about that is that this is an expression of an apologetic strategy on the part of Buddhists that goes back to the late 19th century, when Buddhists, especially in Sri Lanka, faced with the challenge of Christian missionaries and of colonial empire, found it an advantageous strategy to claim not only that Buddhism was in fact compatible with science, but in fact that it was more compatible with the deliverances of science than Christian thought. And so this is a line of thought advanced by people like Anagarika Dhammapala, a Sri Lankan Buddhist who represented the Buddhist tradition to the World Parliament of Religions in the late 19th century. So there's long been an apologetic strategy having very much to do with the conditions of colonialism and missionary work and power and contestation that have made it an advantageous apologetic strategy to think about Buddhism and science. And we should ask in that regard, whose power is advanced by these kinds of claims about the compatibility of Buddhism and cognitive science? What's the agenda that's advanced by representing these traditions that way? And why should either one of these traditions be thought to need the prestige or authority that goes with the other? Is it Buddhism that comes out looking better if it's underwritten by cognitive scientific research, or is Buddhism instead lending to cognitive scientific research its prestige as a spiritual tradition, or whatever? So that's one set of reasons why we should be suspicious of these facile and pretty common claims about Buddhism and cognitive science. Another and more important reason is a philosophical reason, and my orientation is to these materials is philosophical, so this is, at the end of the day, the more interesting kind of reason for me. And that is that Buddhists, and I'll just stipulate henceforth that I'm talking about first millennium Indian Buddhists. Whenever you hear people make claims about Buddhism in general, much less Eastern religions in general, you should always be suspicious, because these are internally very complex systems of belief, and Indian Buddhism is extremely different from Chinese Buddhism, for example. So I'm talking about first millennium Indian Buddhism, which, by the way, is the Buddhism that is basically normative for Tibetan Buddhists. So many of the thinkers that I take my bearings from are still actually alive as part of the curriculum in a Tibetan Buddhist monastic tradition. But Buddhists, meaning first millennium Indian Buddhists, Buddhists are emphatically not physicalists. They're dualists. And this is something that puts them profoundly at odds with the orientation of most cognitive scientific researchers. And certainly at odds with most philosophers who take their bearings from cognitive scientific research. So what I'm engaging is really not cognitive scientific research at all, but philosophers of mind who think that cognitive scientific research answers the questions of philosophy of mind. And these thinkers tend to be physicalists, by which I mean they think that everything about the mind, everything about the mental, must finally be explicable in terms of facts about the brain and central nervous system. And this is another counterintuitive point. Buddhists, even though they are reductionists about persons, even though they think that we are without any ultimately existing selves, even though they think we can reduce what we think of as persons to just series of fleeting events, were nevertheless strong dualists. They thought there were that mental events were essentially different from physical events. And not only did they think this, but it was a profoundly important commitment of theirs, because that's how rebirth is possible. It's because the mental series is independent of the body that at death, the mental series can continue begin what we think of as another life, despite the obvious fact that the body doesn't continue. So Buddhists were reductionists about the self, but were also dualists and very strongly committed to the reality of the mental as something distinct in kind from the physical. So that's yet another reason for being suspicious of claims about the harmony of Buddhism and cognitive science. But perhaps the deepest reasons of all, and this is what I want to develop at greatest length, is that we should be suspicious about the claims of cognitive scientific research in general, and we should be impressed by the philosophical arguments for profound problems and shortcomings in this kind of approach. What I want to suggest in telling you something about how some of these arguments go, is that we should conclude not only that it's problematic to think of Buddhism as especially compatible with cognitive science, but we should be suspicious in general of pretty much all of the contemporary discourse of cognitive scientific research vis-a-vis religion, because I think philosophical investigation of the issues here discloses a pretty great extent to which we don't really know what we're talking about, and that it's premature to suppose that the kinds of questions cognitive scientific research answers have anything to do with characteristically religious claims or belief. So the angle of the most recent book I've developed then is starts from observing that notwithstanding the popularity of Buddhism plus cognitive science equals great, notwithstanding the popularity of that sort of equation, Buddhists are dualists, not physicalists, that notwithstanding all of that, it turns out that a lot of the arguments against physicalism as a view in philosophy of mind, work against a certain Buddhist school of thought, too. So the thought of my most recent book is that even though Indian Buddhists would strongly disagree with cognitive scientific researchers on this point, on the question of physicalism, there's something underlying their approach that is more like the cognitive scientific sort of approach than unlike, such that they're both vulnerable to some of the same problems. So maybe the extent to which certain Buddhists are similar to cognitive scientific philosophers is so much the worse for those Buddhists. Maybe neither project fares well. And the category, the philosophical category that I developed in the book as a way to get clear on what problems are commonly faced by both of these approaches, is the conversation centering on the term intentionality in a philosophically technical sense of that word. So intentionality is a term of art in Western philosophy. One of the few terms of art that figures just as prominently in continental philosophy as it does in Anglo-American philosophy. There's, I think, maybe a story to be told about this as the category that sort of unites a lot of prima facie disparate 20th century philosophical conversations. But intentionality in this philosophically technical sense refers to aboutness, refers to the fact that mind is about other things, that mental things like believing or having a thought or having a reason, any mental item like that is characterized by its being about something, by its having some content. And this has been proposed as a hallmark of the mental. This is the thing that defines the mental as opposed to other kinds of things. So whatever you could say, for example, about the relation of this podium to its environment, its being to the north of certain things and to the south of other things, its being made of wood, its having been made in such and such. Whatever you could say about its relations to the environment, you wouldn't say it's about anything. It's not taking anything in the environment as the meaning of its inner states. This is a distinctive feature of thought. Although, and not coincidentally, it's a distinctive feature of language, too. So in this category, we see something of how closely thought and language go together, because the one other kind of thing that we would might maybe say is exhibits aboutness is things like sentences, stories, claims. Sentences and stories and claims are also about something. They're also about what they mean. And the question, the philosophical question, is really whether this fact about the mind, whether intentionality, whether this fact about the mind can admit of a cognitive scientific explanation, whether in particular it can be explained in causal terms. Because cognitive scientific researchers, or at least the philosophers who follow them, always tend to think at the end of the day that you've only explained something if you've given a causal explanation of it, if you've shown how it works in causal terms. Why would it be in principle hard to explain intentionality in causal terms? Well, the main reason is that there's a strong argument to the effect that our thought is only meaningfully about anything to the extent that we experience the things that our thoughts are about as some way or another. We experience things always under some description. We don't tend to walk into a room and have, as our first moment of experience, undifferentiated welter of shapes and colors. We tend to come in and think furniture or theater or trees. We take things as exemplifying certain kinds. We take things under some description. And it's this fact that's especially hard to explain in causal terms. So, for example, it would seem that sensory perception is the kind of thing that would admit of causal explanation, right? You see a tree, and you can explain that event of experience in terms of light reflected off the object, impacting your retina and stimulating the optic nerve and causing the arising of a mental image, right? So this would seem like the paradigm case of a kind of awareness that will, in fact, admit of causal explanation. And I think partly for this reason, physicalists in philosophy of mind tend to be empiricists. They tend to privilege sense perception. They tend to think, this is where the rubber hits the road. This is where our awareness really comes up against the world. But when we notice that we don't, in fact, ever have sensory perceptions that are just uninterpreted, we don't have experiences that consist simply in manifold shapes. We always experience things as something or another. That part of the experience can't as obviously be explained in causal terms. So you see a tree, there's a vertical object out there that stimulates the optic nerve. Well, that could be taken as all kinds of different things. You could experience that as a tree or as a maple, or as suitable firewood, or as a place to hide. And any of those descriptions under which you could experience it isn't itself caused by the object in the same way that the mental image is. So the part of our experience that resists this kind of causal scientific explanation is the part that makes it an experience. It's the part that makes it meaningful. It's the concepts. It's the conceptual part. This is a basically Kantian point, that without some concepts too, you don't yet have experience. So if you think that perceptual experience can in fact be described simply in causal terms, that would be tantamount to saying that all kinds of bare stimulus responders also have experience. A bar of iron rusts when it's exposed to oxygen. That's something causally responding to a stimulus. Well, that's not all there is to experience, though. There is a causally describable component, but it's the taking it as some way or another that really makes it a contentful experience, and that part can't be explained the same way. And that part, the taking things as some way or another, relates closely to the field of logic, semantics, meaning. Because when you take things as some way or another, when you experience things as a tree, you are entering what the mid-20th century philosopher Wilfred Sellers called the logical space of reasons. So when you experience your perceptual field as something or another. What that means is you are experiencing the things as possibly offering reasons for other things. You are entitled to thoughts like, if this is a dead tree, then it would be good for firewood. Or if this doesn't afford a good place to hide, then I'd better keep looking. And we're into this space of inferential relations with the space that logic is concerned with. So the point in the argument now that we've reached is that logic and meaning won't admit of causal explanation. And it's because of that 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 our experience can't be exhaustively described in causal terms. So, once we realize that, once we realize that thought and experience are really only meaningfully about things insofar as experience always takes things under some description, and once we realize, therefore, that thought is closely and experience is closely implicated with reasoning, we see what the real problem is for making sense of intentionality from a physicalist perspective. And that is, can we give a physicalist account of reasoning, of logic? Can a physicalist philosopher of mind who says that everything about the mental must finally be explained in terms of brain events, can they explain how reasoning works and what reasoning is? This is the reason, I think, for the attraction of the computer metaphor in a lot of contemporary philosophy, because we seem to have in computers the case of something that will admit of causal explanation that nevertheless reproduces calculations or reasons. So, what's the argument against that? What's the argument for thinking that not only that we haven't yet given an explanation of reasoning in physical terms, but an argument even stronger to the effect that we never could, that there could not be an argument that could make sense of this, that there's nothing it could look like to explain this. The compelling argument I have in mind is one from Kant. So here's how that argument goes. Suppose you want to argue as follows. Suppose you want to argue everything about the mental consists entirely in brain events. Everything there is to thinking and reasoning consists in causal transactions among neuroelectrical states and so on. You think you're doing things for reasons, you think you have beliefs, but at the end of the day, they're not really real. We can explain those away. That's the position you want to argue for. And this is, as some contemporary philosophers have argued, when they say, well, our own experience of ourselves as reasoning and believing things is comparable to, is as they often say, a folk psychology. It's comparable to a theory that will one day be jettisoned. Our sentimental view of ourselves as doing things for reasons will one day go the way of ether and phlogiston. It will be shown just to be a theoretical posit that we can do without. The argument against this is, how could we possibly make sense of that claim except by reasoning for it? So somebody's trying to argue for us, there are no real beliefs, there are no real reasons, there is no reasoning that's irreducible to brain states. It's all just physical stuff all the way down. How can we make sense of that claim as possibly true? And what reason could we have to be persuaded by it? And Kant's thought is, you can't, nothing does. Anything at all that would make sense to us as an explanation or a theory on this would make sense to us and be intelligible to us only because it would already be the contents of our reasoning. We can never get around that and get outside of it and explain it from the other side. And what this recommends is the conclusion that intentionality is both, in some important respect, not exhaustively explainable in causal scientific terms, and ineliminable. You can't get rid of it. It's a basic fact about us. It's not a theory that it would be open to us to accept or reject. We can't make any sense of the idea of doing without it. It's the perspective from which any theory would make sense. How could we make sense of coming to believe a new theory which shows that believing isn't really real? So this is the line of argument that I developed in the book. I will leave aside the extent to which I was concerned in the book to show that that same argument not only works against physicalists, but also works against certain Buddhist schools of thought. And I do want to emphasize at least that I argue in the book that it only cuts against certain Buddhist schools of thought, not all Buddhist schools of thought. And in fact, one of the ways I show that is by enlisting another Buddhist school of thought and showing that their critique of their fellow Buddhists makes something like the same argument. But it does suggest, what I do want to retain from the more Buddhological part of the book is, and just commend to your attention, is that one of the things we see by appreciating that these arguments work just as well in identifying problems in some first millennium Indian philosophy is that we see that there's an important sense in which first millennium Indian philosophers were arguing about the same things, and that the issues they were arguing about are still no closer to being settled than they were then, despite the huge advances in understanding of the brain and central nervous system. We still are no clearer on just what it is that we're talking about when we talk about mind. So two directions I would just suggest that one might go with this. First of all, some implications of this with respect to trends in religious studies. I said that in religious studies these days, there's a lot of enthusiasm for cognitive scientific research. The most recent issue of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion has a whole roundtable discussion on the promise of cognitive scientific research. And a lot of that research in religious studies is driven by a trend in recent decades away from the view that religion is primarily a matter of doctrine and belief. This is often characterized as a characteristically Protestant sort of view that really held sway in the 19th and early 20th centuries, the idea that religion consists in faith in certain claims and in commitment to certain doctrines. And in recent decades, people have said, no, let's attend to ritual and practice and embodied religion and see religion as the much more complex phenomenon that it is. That's all very well and good. That's fine. But a lot of, especially cognitive scientific enthusiasts, have gone as far as to argue that, well, belief and doctrine, are now in a position to see, not only shouldn't be the main focus of religious studies, we can coherently do without them altogether. We don't need to talk about these. We can exhaust the phenomenon of religion by giving impersonal, objective, scientific explanations of how religious activities come to be undertaken and so on. And the argument of this book, the argument that, in fact, we can't make sense of that. We can't make sense of the thought that reason and belief might really be something else, also recommends the conclusion that religions aren't what they are, religious activities aren't what they are, and can't be what they are, apart from some reference to beliefs and reasons. That if you individuate some religious event or practice as what it is that you're trying to explain. You can't even individuate it without having some sense in mind of what the people doing it think they're doing, what their reasons for doing it are. Second way one can go with this, and I was talking about this with Pete Dula earlier today, if one wanted to go a more theological direction from this, with this, and enlist this kind of argument as supporting some characteristically religious claims, the promise of going that route is suggested by a neglected essay by a neglected philosopher called A Neglected Argument for the Reality of God. The neglected philosopher is Charles Sanders Peirce, not as neglected the last few decades as he was for a long time. Late 19th, early 20th century philosopher, American philosopher, arguably the greatest American philosopher, and certainly the greatest scientist philosopher, was a practicing scientist and mathematician and logician and quite a polymath, languished in obscurity for the end of his life, and it was only decades later that his writings started to be collected and studied. And in this neglected essay by him, A Neglected Argument for the Reality of God, he does two different things. What's his neglected argument for the reality of God? Well, part of the argument is to say that there's a difference between what he calls argument and argumentation. He says argumentation means like the kind of thing I'm doing now. It means systematic attempts at persuasion using formally valid reasoning and so forth. Whereas argument means any thought process that tends to incline someone towards belief. And so part of his argument is to say, well, we should credit the validity and the importance of that more informal kind of reasoning. Any kind of thought process that inclines someone towards belief is to be credited as something worth taking seriously. The second part of the argument is to say, if you engage in that kind of thought, if you engage in what he calls musing or in the free play of thought, one of the things you will come to realize is that reason, meaning, logic, value, all of these overlapping things that have to do with what Sellars called the logical space of reason, are not only ineliminable from scientific practice, they are the very basis thereof. So I'll just read some passages from Peirce. He says, suppose reasoning can be explained just as that any intended act of mine is supposed by materialistic determinists to have come about. Still, what of it? Does materialistic explanation, supposing it granted, show that reason has nothing to do with my actions? There is a reason, an interpretation, a logic in the course of scientific advance, and this indisputably proves to him who has perceptions of rational or significant relations that man's mind must have been attuned to the truth of things in order to discover what he has discovered. It is the very bedrock of logical truth. Perhaps a regrettable choice of passage that vindicates the thought Pete shared with me that Peirce is not always the most lucid writer. Try this one. Here's a punchier one. Tell me, he says, upon sufficient authority that all cerebration depends upon movements of neurites that strictly obey certain physical laws, and thus that all expressions of thought, both external and internal, receive a physical explanation, and I shall be ready to believe you. Okay, I can make sense of what the physicalist is after. But if you go on to say that this explodes the theory that my neighbor and myself are governed by reason and are thinking beings, I must frankly say that it will not give me a high opinion of your intelligence. He's making the same argument here. His neglected argument for the reality of God is the argument that reason is ineliminable from an account of what we are and what we're like, and that should occasion a properly religious kind of awe. It should astonish us that despite the enormous promise of cognitive scientific research and despite the compelling grip that science seems to give us on the understanding of the brain and central nervous system, we still have no idea exactly what we're talking about when we talk about mind. And that fact is a fact we can't get around, because anything we could come to understand on the subject will already ipso facto be part of our reasoning. We can never get around that. And that should astonish us, he thinks. So you could think, if you were so inclined, that what this line of argument gets you is an argument for the reality of God. That's all I've got to say, unless there are questions or comments.
Evolution. As far as I understand, one of the biggest problems with a dualist version of reality or of mind is, when does it start? And how do you deal with that question?
Well, this is, in fact, probably the biggest question here. The modern philosopher I have most enlisted in thinking through this is John McDowell, who's basically a modern Kantian. This is the most recurrent challenge put to him. This is sometimes called the problem of infralinguals, the problem of sublinguistic beings, where that includes both non-linguistic animals and pre-linguistic humans. So we know, we have a pretty clear understanding of the idea that somewhere along the way there came into being animals evolutionarily related to non-linguistic animals that are themselves linguistic. And we know very well in the case of humans that pre-linguistic humans end up being linguistic. And this whole view of mind and intentionality seems to presuppose or posit a sharp discontinuity where everything about our theories would lead us to expect continuity. And I'm frankly not sure there's a good answer to that. I am impressed by the intractability of the problem, though, sort of trying to locate it on an evolutionary time scale. Doesn't make the problem go away, doesn't make the difficulty go away. The leap from causal relations to the logical space of reasons does seem like a leap. And it does seem like a different kind of being and relating comes into being with that. One philosophical position that maybe more closely acknowledges this is emergence in philosophy of mind, which says, well, yes, everything about the mental depends on physical events and processes, but it's not reducible to them, that with a certain degree of organization and complexity having emerged, there comes into being a new kind of thing, namely mind. But it doesn't come from any mysterious non-physical stuff, but having come into being, you can't infer from it back to the material cause. It's a different kind of thing that has come into being. Another thing I'm inclined to say just about this line of question in general, what I'm inclined to say about what I think this argument shows about the confidence we should or shouldn't have in scientific thinking. The main thing I'm prepared to conclude, because I don't conclude from this to any sort of mind-spirit dualism, and I don't conclude to any kind of theism either, but I am prepared to conclude that this is pretty good evidence that we don't understand causation, and that to the extent that our thought that a certain kind of scientific explanation must be right, and to the extent that we can only imagine that as consisting in physical causal explanation, this is an argument powerful enough to show that that can't be right, that there's something about that kind of explanation that just can't be adequate. What to do about that, I don't know. Sorry, there was a...
No, I was just going to say that the categories of physicalism and dualism don't exhaust all the possibilities. So, for example, non-reductive physicalism, And it does seem to me that you can account for our capacity to track truth by these embodied animal habits that we have of figuring out whether the buzzing sound is a bee or a wasp or a fly by stepping closer or moving our head a little bit. And I am impressed by studies that look at mice and their capacity to solve mazes and whether this is simply about memorizing the way to do it or whether they are navigating the maze. And it turns out that they're navigating the maze. And so they must be capable of representing the maze to themselves and not necessarily picturing, but in some way.
They're exercising a skill.
Yes, that's right. And it's deeply environmental. It has to do with space. And so they have as structure to some extent, which is remarkable.
Well, I do think I was at a conference earlier this summer, an NEH Summer Institute, earlier this summer, I say as though it's still summer, last summer, an NEH Summer Institute on consciousness, Buddhist and contemporary perspectives, and there was a lot on embodied cognition and embodied cognitive science, and I do think that's considerably more nuanced and sophisticated than the view I sort of had in my sights was the computational version of cognitive science, which a lot of people have abandoned. So Jerry Fodor and Daniel Dennett were my foils. I still think, though, that somewhere along the way, when you want to account for the difference between causal relations and normative relations, wherever that gap ends up arising, it's going to be the same problem. And if, no matter how nuanced and embodied and flexible it is, if causal relations are the only kind that are real for a certain kind of scientific account, you're never going to get the other part into the picture. And yet another option that has recently been re-entertained, somewhat to my delight, just partly because I'm a contrarian and I like to see a long-dismissed option re-emerging, is panpsychism. This is a physician associated with Alfred North Whitehead, for example, who says, well, precisely insofar as you can't get the features of experience out of physical stuff, it must be the case that physical stuff instantiates experience, and that there is no difference in kind between mind and rocks. It's a difference in complexity and organization. And a few people in recent years have started to entertain more seriously the thought that something like that might be right, which I take to be, if nothing else, an acknowledgement of the intractability of the problem.
I realize, listening to you and Christian, that philosophical discourse has its own jargon that I don't fully track. But I'm a sociologist, and I was really interested in your comments about the explosion of interest within religious studies in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And also your comments on the shift within religious studies from looking at a belief and doctrine to looking at ritual and practice. Mm-hmm. So my hypothesis, if I put those two things together, is that Buddhism then is the perfect foil for religious studies moving from looking at belief and doctrine to ritual and practice, because it's all about ritual and practice. And so it makes sense to me that that's where the field has gone, to a particular focus on a religion that is less about belief and doctrine than any other, at least, major world religion.
I do think the move away from a narrow focus on belief and doctrine has a lot to do with increasing awareness of world religions, and increasing awareness of, I mean, religion is by nature a comparative category. We only get the idea that there's one thing, one kind of thing called religion, and that Buddhism and Hinduism and Christianity are all examples of that one thing, after we encounter opposing examples and come to a judgment that, well, this is relevantly like that. So it's just to call anything a religion is already... There's been, partly in the post-World War II, post-colonial period, increasing attention to the emergence of religion as a comparative category, and noting that, well, gosh, it looks like the things that are taken best to epitomize or to be most authentic about religion, is it just a coincidence that they happen to mesh pretty well with Protestant Christianity? And so a lot of it's just sort of examining the history of the emergence of that category and pressure being put on that category from other traditions about which we have increasing awareness and increasingly sophisticated awareness. The other reason I'd resist that way of telling the story is that Buddhist thought, too, has lots in the way of thought and doctrine. The guys I work on are, I work on scholastic philosophers who are doing epistemology and logic and metaphysics, and you know what they're doing looks more like Thomas Aquinas than like spinning prayer wheels. And although I would also give a brief, if I had time, for the continuity between those, that it's misleading to think that they're two fundamentally different kinds of activities. There's theorizing and thinking about it, and there's practice. I would want to locate those on a continuum. Does that count as answering your question?
Thanks, Dan. So my question is partly the question we were talking about earlier about implications for Christian theology, and I wonder if one way to get at that is, you made it very clear you were talking about first millennium Buddhist philosophers, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how contemporary Buddhists negotiate this question of dualism, and I'm thinking of it as a Christian theologian who sort of, it's kind of culturally necessary to kind of bow to the prestige of science relative to theology. And so if you need to talk about the soul or the afterlife, you do it very quietly. But then reading your book and your stuff, you know, I think, oh, wow. I mean, Dan's defending the Buddhists here. Maybe there's a way for us to do this too. So can you talk a little bit about how, are there any contemporary Buddhist thinkers you like that are negotiating this particularly well?
Sure, there's a whole range. I know contemporary Buddhist thought much less well, but there are a lot of, it's an interesting fact about Buddhist studies that an unusually large percentage of Buddhist studies scholars are themselves Buddhists, which is different from Hindu studies or this is an often remarked sociological fact that convert Buddhists are apt to become Buddhologists. And a lot of those kinds of people are, you know, real enthusiasts for things like the Mind Life Institute based in New York, which is all about encouraging MRI scans of Tibetan Buddhist meditators and whatnot. And those people are pretty apt to say, I think, that, well, the dualism and the rebirth and whatnot is not really essential to the teachings. They're apt, in other words, to kind of demythologize the tradition and say, well, look, the core insights of the tradition don't actually depend on that. We can get the most important things out of Buddhist thought without those commitments. I think there's a case to be made for that. A popular writer who does a similar sort of thing is a guy named Stephen Batchelor. He's got a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs, arguing that the most authentically Buddhist orientation is a skeptical one. But that amounts to a similar sort of move to saying that that amounts to a claim to identify what is actually essential to the tradition, and a claim that dualism and rebirth aren't part of that. So it's a theological sort of move that some might resist. An especially interesting case is the Dalai Lama, who's been a really high profile participant in some of these conversations, but who I'm given to understand is actually kind of skeptical about some of it. He really thinks that it's integral, and he's partly hoping for the survival of a culture. He's partly hoping for the continued survival of Tibetan culture and Tibetan language and literature and education. And he thinks that it's really important for traditionally trained Tibetan monastics to learn about science. But despite his participation in a bunch of these mind science dialogues, I'm given to understand he's kind of skeptical about that and kind of agnostic himself about that. And he's sort of famously refused to answer questions like, after you die, will there be a subsequent Dalai Lama? And he has said he's open to the thought that there won't be, which he would explain to his followers as his choice not to be reborn. Interestingly, it's the Chinese then who have insisted most strongly that there will be a subsequent one, and he'll be found in China by us. So people who are not themselves scholar practitioners, but just do what I do, who are interested in sympathetically reconstructing the arguments and just engage. You know, what I do is I just try to study these guys as philosophers. I try to take them seriously as philosophers and study them the same way people in philosophy departments study Kant or Hegel. Take the arguments seriously where they seem promising, criticize them where they seem problematic. And there are people doing that kind of thing who've also found it important to ask, well, is Buddhist thought compatible with physicalism? And it's not a silly position to claim that it is. I mean, the idea that rebirth is possibly not integral to the tradition isn't a silly claim. Rebirth tends to have almost no significance in Chinese Buddhism. Buddhism originates in India in a context where it's already taken as axiomatic that, of course, there's rebirth. They had a special problem of explaining how it makes sense and how it's possible if there's no self that is reborn, but that's a pretty easy problem to solve. But then when Indian Buddhism is transmitted to China, where there isn't already that belief, and where, in fact, there are beliefs that mitigate against it, that gets downplayed to the vanishing point. So that's an example of what I doubt anybody would say is not an authentic Buddhist tradition that doesn't talk much about it. The Buddhist thinker that I engage and criticize, somebody I'm ultimately unsympathetic with, there's another Buddhist school of thought that I think is more nearly right. But this guy, Dharmakirti's his name, still hugely influential in the Tibetan scholastic curriculum. He clearly thought it was really important, to the extent that he was one of the only Indian Buddhists who made an argument for it, because again, they could just sort of take it as axiomatic. Everybody believes it in this context. So I don't know if that's helpful. I think the shorter answer is just that, I think you have the same range of accommodations that you probably find in Christian theology.
Any other quick comment or question?
Thank you very much for your talk. Maybe just to do a little of that Christian theological engagement, I was just thinking as you were talking about this idea that every sense perception we have is mediated by categories of we see a tree and not the sky, or sky and ground and tree. And that there maybe were pre-linguistic humans, and when did this emergent property of reasoning come about? And I was just thinking, just for some reason, Genesis 1 text came to my mind of, here's this picture of this churning waters of chaos, which might be like, and also how a child, when a child is born, and maybe you could speak to that, isn't there also not only an evolutionary process, but just when a child is born, it also is just experiencing pure sensory experience with no categories, kind of a chaos, maybe.
I gather that's been really questioned in recent years. I don't keep up.
They're already innately have some kind of categorical.
William James used to say that the experience of an infant is just a blooming, buzzing confusion, and I'm given to understand, this is not something I keep up on, but that in early childhood development studies, they're increasingly aware that, in fact, there's a lot of very sophisticated processing going on from an early point.
So. I guess I know to look for the breast is one thing,
Well, which interestingly is one of the things that figures in the Buddhist proof of rebirth, that a baby knows to do that a baby knows to nurse, that a baby has that conceptual capacity is a function of his having seen that before in a previous lifetime.
But just to finish my rambling thought here, so maybe what we're seeing here is a picture of, this kind of waters of chaos and its undifferentiated sensory experience, and then the word, the word is spoken and, reasoning, and then it's all the separation of land, sky from the earth, and land from the sea, and plants from animals, all these organizing categories. Or maybe what Genesis is describing is this emergent property of reasoning or of whether it's on evolutionary thought or from birth, you know, throwing that out there, maybe is it getting that where that shift occurs, and it doesn't explain it anymore, how the word came to be, except maybe you call it the creator, speaks the word, and there's light, enlightenment, reasoning.
Well, I think it's not for nothing that the Christian and lots of other religious traditions have thought of language as a particularly compelling and awe-inspiring fact about us. And in fact, the first millennium Indian philosophy, if you take away nothing else from this talk, take away this, Indian philosophy had the most sophisticated tradition of reflection on language of any philosophical tradition in the world. The grammarian Panini, who wrote what is to this day still the most nearly complete generative grammar for a language, wrote in the 5th century BC. Nobody's done a more sophisticated job on language since then. But the debates in philosophy of mind that I was unearthing are very often framed in the Indian context in terms of debates about the status of linguistic universals. And so part of what I was arguing is that when they have these seemingly arcane debates about whether or not the reference of words are real and concepts are real, or whether instead they can be explained, they're having debates about philosophy of mind. And interestingly, one of the schools of thought, this is a Hindu school of thought that I enlisted to support my case for thinking that certain Buddhists are vulnerable to this line of argument, is the Hindu school of thought that was most profound in its reification of language. They argued that language is eternal. That language is eternal and uncreated, and that the Vedic texts are eternal and uncreated. And I tried to suggest that that's not as daft an argument as it sounds like, that there is a compelling point they're getting, and it's this, and the point I suggest they get is the same point I was trying to make about the ineliminable character of conceptual thought. So their basic argument for the eternality of language, their most compelling one, is that no particular linguistic act could coherently be thought to be the first one. Because if you imagine people sitting around saying, well, let's call this fire, we can only imagine that event as itself a linguistic act. That we can only imagine people creating language if the parties to that act already had language. So there's another tradition's perhaps even stronger emphasis on the uncanny character of language.